Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations, coast to coast and border to border here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on destroyed arguments, right after this message. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce, and government gets about 60%. That's about $20,000 for you and about $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just kind of real special? But if you make this $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. And then on top of that, you pay a 17% income tax on that $50,000. Now, that's another $8,500. Now, $8,500 and $7,650, you know, you total those up, or you subtract one from the other, and you find that you've paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. You see, you didn't subtract that $7,650 when you computed that 17% to come up with your income tax. Now, that makes the real effective Social Security tax 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's being advertised. Now, isn't that just real neat? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? It's 417-273-4967 and help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and Status is a school that I teach. It's available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about destroyed arguments. Larry Beecraft, remember, the tax attorney from Huntsville, Alabama. He's had a pretty illustrious career in defending people on tax charges. I can't think of anybody in the country that's had a better success rate in defending tax protesters for willful failure to file or tax evasion or some other form of tax charge. He's a pretty good old boy, a little bit older than I am. And he's a straight shooter. If I was going to recommend an attorney, you know, Larry would be right at the top of the heap. I've recommended him over the years to a number of people, and they've been successful in their tax fight with the IRS. My thing in life is you can stay out of more trouble than you can get out of. Did you really want to fight with the government? Did you want to spend, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 defending a case and risking, and in many cases you lose, and then go to jail for 5 years or so? Almost every time that you get prosecuted by the government, you'll end up in divorce, lose your home and your job and all of your toys, spend a few years in prison. You can recover from that. You know, most people will come out of prison and they'll get out into the real world and make a living. Sometimes a professional man loses his profession. You know, if you're a doctor, a dentist, or something like that, and chiropractor, and you get a felony conviction, you'll lose your license and you won't be able to practice your profession from that point on. That's not a very good prospect now, is it? And going to prison isn't the last or the biggest problem in the world, or the last great problem that you're going to face in life, but it's not a very pleasant one. You'll survive it, but it's not something that you're going to be talking about and saying, boy, wasn't that a great experience in life? I'd like to do that one over again. So remember, you can stay out of more trouble than you can get out of. And that's why Larry wrote this. He's simply saying to all of us, the courts have already ruled on these destroyed arguments, as he labels them or calls them, these issues that have been raised. And remember, there are hundreds of these issues. He's only got about 20 or 30 here that I'm going to cover here in this series of programs. But there are hundreds of them. So I mentioned last time that the government, that is the courts, from 1964 to 84, 85, long in there, about 20 years or so, did about 100 cases a year. Now, that's a lot of cases on this subject matter of taxes. And over the years, 100 cases a year, 20 years, 2,000 cases, the courts have just about exhausted every conceivable argument or idea that people can come up with. And so now we're rehashing these ideas. I remember when I first got started in law, I was a businessman in Boise, Idaho, when I was introduced to this thing of pro se litigation up there in Idaho. And when I started back in 1978, there was a tax protest scheme that was afoot called the Fifth Amendment Return. And when it was explained to me, just being a normal, everyday, garden-variety businessman, I couldn't understand the logic behind it. I understood the defense, but my worry was this. If this is a legitimate defense to paying income tax, how come my attorney didn't tell me about this? So when I contacted my attorney and asked him about this tax protest thing or this Fifth Amendment return, he said that that was just nonsense. I didn't know any different, but I just listened to my attorney. After all, that's why you hire those guys, you know. And I stayed out of it. Now, I watched these people over the years, and I saw a number of them prosecuted, and a number of them went to jail. And as I pointed out, they lost their homes, and their wives get mad at them, and they divorce them, and then they lose their jobs, and sometimes their professions, and so on. And so after having watched that for a while, I said, well, I don't think I want to do that. I don't want to get involved in that. And so I've been called a tax protester over the years, but I'm not one of those. I'm not protesting any tax. I'm not protesting the IRS. I'm not trying to put the IRS or the Federal Reserve out of business. After all, the people of America want the income tax. The people of America want paper money. They want the Federal Reserve. They want a managed economy. It's been this way since 1933. And those of us that are opposed to the IRS, the income tax, the Federal Reserve, I don't want you to think that I'm in favor of them. I'm opposed to them. But most Americans, I mean, we're talking 90% plus Americans prefer the income tax to any other taxing program. And you could see that in the 1992 and 1996 elections when a fellow by the name of Steve Forbes ran for president. And the central theme of his campaign, he was a Republican, you know, Steve Forbes, he's the head of Forbes magazine. He proposed a flat tax. He said, let's get rid of the income tax and let's tax everybody at the same rate. Now, he didn't subscribe to tithing. He didn't subscribe to the 10% rule. But he subscribed to everybody pays a flat tax. 17%, 12%, 30%. And Americans on both sides of the political spectrum rejected Steve Forbes and the flat tax. Now, you Americans had your opportunity twice in 92 and 96 to vote for, to elect Steve Forbes, and you didn't do that. So that tells me that you preferred the income tax to the flat tax. Now, tithing is a flat tax. Everybody pays 10%. Whether you're rich or poor, doesn't make any difference. And we rejected that in favor of the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for a heavy progressive income tax. So we Americans prefer a heavy progressive income tax to tithing. We're not interested in God's program. And we're not interested in Steve Forbes' program. We want the income tax. Well, you know, I'm just one voice out here. I'm just one guy. I'm not here to try to convince you that I'm right. So years ago, I dropped out of the income tax. I looked at it and said, well, if I don't pay the income tax, they'll want to put me in jail. And I don't want to go to jail. And I don't want to pay the income tax. So I came up with a pretty unique conclusion or solution. Back in 1978, I said, I'm going to stop having income. I'm going to live my life without any income. Now, fortunately, the government allows us to have a little bit of income without paying tax. At the moment that I'm making this program, the number is $7,200. So I can earn $7,200 and I don't have to file a tax return. Now, if I earn over $7,200, then I got to file a tax return. I don't have to pay any income tax until I get up over $15,000. They got a poverty line out here and income tax credit and so on. And the trick to all of this is that you have to obey all the laws of God, all the laws of the United States, and all the laws of your state and do it all simultaneously. So back in 1978, I said, gee, could I do that? It's not easy. It takes a little time, effort, and energy, and it takes some discipline, but you can do it. So I avoided tax protest, and so far I've avoided jail, and I've avoided any contact with the IRS. I've always expected that the IRS would want to audit me, and they'd want to say, hey, well, how do you live without any income? And the answer to that's very well. Thank you. I live very well without income. My great-granddad lived very well without income. In fact, so did yours. This whole concept of income is a new phenomenon that came with communism and the Federal Reserve and the IRS and so on. And we Americans bought into it. And we've been practicing that now for about 70 years or so, or in fact close to 100 years. The IRS and the Federal Reserve came into operation, this income tax, and the IRS came into operation here with this 16th Amendment and the creation of the Federal Reserve back in 1913. And from 1913 on, there has been dissatisfaction among certain Americans, not all Americans, but there is a minority of Americans that are opposed to the income tax, paper money, and the Federal Reserve. I'm one of those. I'm one of that minority. And some of them get a little radicalized, and they've come to the conclusion, we ain't paying that damn tax. And they've come up with a number of reasons why and a number of legal strategies and ideas, and they go out and they promote those and they sell them to other people, and they really sound good. Well, I mean, they sound good. Now, if you'd take this into your tax preparer, I think he would tell you, well, yeah, but that isn't going to work because that's not the state of the law. And for some reason, people don't listen to their tax attorneys or their business attorneys, etc. They don't listen to their accountants and CPAs. They listen to these tax protesters. Irwin Schiff is one of them. Now, Irwin's a nice guy, and I like him. He used to be on the lecture circuit, and I met him a few times, and we had lunch together, and we talked, and I don't agree with his legal philosophies because they don't work. You know, the guy's been convicted 3 times. He's in the process of being convicted a 4th time. And at some point in time, he's going to be convicted as a repeat offender, and then they're going to lock him up for life or something. You know, and I'm sitting here saying, well, I'm opposed to the income tax because it's bad public policy. It's bad economics. It's not good for people. It's not good for the economy. It's not good for our republic. It's not good for our government. It's good for business, especially big business. It's good for government and bureaucracy. It's good for communists and communism. After all, the income tax is communism. It's the second plank. A heavy progressive income tax. Our founding fathers did not give us a heavy progressive income tax in our Constitution. In our Bill of Rights. It's a foreign and alien ideology. We've adopted that foreign and alien ideology. Don't ask me why. I'm just telling you that's what we've done. Now, I looked at it and said, well, I don't think I want to practice the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. I don't think practicing communism is good for me. Now, a lot of Americans have come to the same conclusion. Maybe they did it for different reasons, but a lot of us have come to a conclusion that I don't want to participate in this income tax, and so they've come up with some reasons why they shouldn't pay it. And the non-resident alien, number four here of Larry Becraft's destroyed arguments, is one of those. Remember, of those 2,000 arguments that were developed between 1964 and 1984 by the tax protesters, they came up with this non-resident alien idea. Some contend that we are, for tax purposes, non-resident aliens. Again, this improper argument has been correctly rejected by the courts. So in United States versus Sloan, cited at 939, Fed Second, 499, decided back in 1991, and United States versus Jagim, J-A-G-I-M, 978, Fed Second, 1032, decided in 1992. United States versus Hilgeford, 7 Federal Third Edition, 1340, decided in 1993. Now, those are circuit courts of appeal. So those are pretty important courts. Those are called appellate courts. They take you to trial in federal district court in your hometown, you know, like Kansas City or St. Louis. Those are called federal district courts. And then when you lose, you can appeal. See, and then you appeal to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in Kansas City, or the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Indianapolis, or the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. That's the court that's right under the U.S. Supreme Court. And three judges listen to this argument, and then they look at the constitutionality of your objections, and then they come to a conclusion, and then they rule against you, and then they uphold your conviction from the district court. And then if you don't like that decision from the circuit court, you can appeal to the United States Supreme Court. It's not very likely that the U.S. Supreme Court's going to hear your appeal, but it's possible. It's not impossible. It can be done. And then they uphold your conviction, and then there's no further appeals. You know, there's a limit to how far you can go. Now, most of the time, when you appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court, they decline your appeal. And they say, we're not going to hear it. And then the legal effect of that is, they're saying, in effect, we agree with the lower court, and there's no need for us to review it. We think their decision's correct. And then that's the end of the line. Then you go to jail, and you spend a little time in the slammer, and then you come out, and then you're really bitter, really angry, and you get real angry, and these people are really, really ticked off about government and how unfair and how rotten it is. And I agree, it's unfair and it's rotten, but then, you know, it's the only government we got. It's the only game in town, as one student told me one time. He said, the income tax is the only game in town. Well, this argument has been rejected by the courts, and I'm going to review it just for a second here and think about it for a second, because when it was first proposed to me, I couldn't understand it nor the logic behind it. Non-resident alien, and the gist of it is that the United States federal government is situated in Washington, D.C., and they're limited to that piece of real estate, 10 square miles. They don't have any jurisdiction anyplace else in the country or over any other citizens in the United States. And many of these people will say, well, I'm a citizen of California, or I'm a citizen of New York, and I'm not a citizen of the United States, so therefore the United States of America can't tax me. At least that's what was explained to me. And I've had students here, and when I make that kind of a statement, you know, I'll say, well, that's the way I understood that, they'll say, oh, no, that's not the way that works. Say, we've expatriated our citizenship. You know, we're citizens of someplace else, and we're non-resident aliens. Well, I don't know what what your idea is or what some of these people's ideas are. They're pretty conflicting a lot of time. But in the final analysis, when you walk into court, you walk into the federal district court and you say, well, I'm a non-resident alien and I don't have to pay the income tax, then I guess the judge sits there and says, well, excuse me, did you have income? Let's suppose you're a non-resident alien. you're just a tourist that came over here to the United States from let's say Brazil, and you're just a tourist. Did you work here in the United States and earn any money? Now, as far as I can tell, most of these people that are claiming that they're non-resident aliens and don't owe the income tax, they're working someplace. And one of the conditions on coming to the United States as a tourist is that you don't work here. That's why Americans or a lot of Americans are pretty concerned about all these Mexicans coming across the border. They call them illegal aliens coming here to work. See, that's against the law. So did you come in here as an illegal alien, and are you working in the United States and violating that law, and then saying, well, because I'm from Mexico or Brazil or someplace, I don't have to pay the income tax? Well, no, these people are all white Anglo-Saxons. They were born here in the United States, and they've picked up on some kind of a legal argument that they think has got some merit, and they go into court and they make that argument. And the judges and the juries, that's another thing. See, most of these people have jury trials, and you'd think that the juries that are convicting all of these people, and almost every time these tax protesters will have a jury trial. Now, you'd think that the juries would say, you know, we're just going to turn these people loose. We're not going to convict people because we disagree with this income tax. You see, the people sitting on the jury, they all pay their income tax. They're team players. They're American workers, and they believe in the income tax. They're practicing communists. And they like it, and they want it. And that's why they didn't vote for Steve Forbes. They voted for Bob Dole in 96, and they voted for Bill Clinton in 92. Now, George Bush Sr., he was all in favor of the income tax. So was Bill Clinton in 92. Bill Clinton was all in favor of the income tax in 96. So was Bob Dole. Now, most Americans are in favor of the income tax. Why would George Gordon want to get in the way of the majority view? I don't. Americans want to practice the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. All right, now that being the case, can you see your problem when you go into trial, when you go into court? The judge pays an income tax. The jury pays the income tax. The prosecutor and the IRS agents all pay an income tax. And you're walking in to this court and you're saying, well, I don't pay it and I don't have to because I'm a non-resident alien. Well, which law are you in violation of? Are you in violation of the law that says pay your income tax, or are you in violation of the law that says you can't work here if you're a tourist? You got to be a citizen. So Congress changed that a little bit. They came around, they said, well, if you're going to work here, you got to have an I-9 form and you got to prove that you're a citizen to work. Well, of course, you could work under the table, but you know, most of these people that get caught with tax evasion or willful failure to file, they're not working under the table for cash. That's what the Mexicans do. See, they come in here and they work under the table for cash, and then they send their money back home, and they don't have a problem. But if you're going to take a job here at General Motors and you get paid every week and deposit your money in the bank, then they've got records of it. It doesn't take them very long to figure out, you know, that you're making money here. So if you're going to be a tax protester, it would seem like to me that you'd have to be a little bit craftier in committing the crime. And I haven't seen too many crafty people committing that kind of crime. So there's the story that I've seen on non-resident aliens. Larry Becraft comes to the same conclusion. And on that score, he's got five cases where this has been taken into court, argued and litigated, taken up on appeal, and the appellate courts have restricted or rejected that argument called non-resident alien. So next time somebody says, well, you don't have to pay an income tax because you're a non-resident alien, or you could claim or you could become a non-resident alien, you want to keep in mind that that's been tested and tried and rejected by the courts. And I contend that the way to do this is to do what the winners do and avoid what the losers do. If somebody's already done this and lost, you can rest assured that when you do it, you're going to lose also. It's the way the game is played. All right, let's take a look at the Form 1040 is really a codicil to a will. The first time I heard that was probably 10 years ago, and a guy came in here and he used the word codicil. I said, what's that? And he tried to explain it to me, and he wasn't getting anywhere. I said, gee, let's look this up, and let's look it up in the legal dictionary, Black's or Bouvier's, and find out what it is. And I did, and it's an amendment to a will. And I thought to myself, what does a will, escrow, probate, death tax, inheritance tax, have to do with the income tax? And this guy was explaining it to me, and I couldn't understand what he was trying to say. And that's another clue. You know, most of us have a little bit of what we call common sense. My granddad used to say, you know, that guy hasn't got sense enough to carry guts to a barrel. Or he hasn't got any common sense. Well, common sense is just reason, logic, and common sense. Does it make any sense to you that a codicil, an amendment to a will, that has something to do with probate, inheritance, has something to do with the income tax? You know, I said, well, what's the connecting link there? And for some reason, when people get these ideas in their heads, boy, I mean, they really get evangelistic zeal. It's almost like religion, you know. And once you ever talk to a Baptist, I mean, those guys, they really have some pretty hard and fast conclusions and beliefs, don't they? I mean, Catholics, you know, they're kind of wishy-washy. They really don't know what they believe, but boy, those Baptists, they really do. And boy, once they glom onto that, it doesn't make any difference if it's biblical or scriptural, if it's reasonable or logical, or they just glom onto it. And that's, at least that's my observation. So if you're a Baptist, don't get mad at me, you know, just, that's just my observation. And they're not the only ones, but they get this religious fervor, and the tax protesters do the same thing. And I mean, this guy was so convinced that this codicil to a will argument here was the winning argument that he, and the reason he came to school here was because he was in tax trouble. And of course he went on to argue this, and he lost. Well, Beecraft looked this up. He's just got one case here. This argument was rejected in Ritchie versus Indiana Department of State Revenue at 634 Northeast 2nd 1375 in 1994, along with other popular arguments of that date. Now remember that Larry Beecraft here has not put in all of the arguments. He's got about 20 or 30 here. These are some of the more common ones. I have never heard of anybody who go into court arguing that the Form 1040 is a codicil. It's an amendment to a will. I've never seen anything in the literature, and here's what I do. I go into, cases such as, these cases that are being cited here by Beecraft, like United States versus Daly, and United States versus Scott, and United States versus Gardner, and so on. And I look to see if any of these buzzwords are in these cases, or what the judge has to say about it. What does the appellate court, in their opinion, have to say about a codicil to a will or to non-resident alien status? They're not bashful. The judges will say this is a specious argument. It's frivolous. It's nonsensical. It doesn't have any merit. It's not the state of the law in the United States, and so on. I mean, they're not bashful. They just tell you plainly that it's just nonsense. Well, now, how are you going to take this argument into court that has been rejected as being nonsense and then prevail? If everybody that's ever done it lost, how are you going to do it and win? And that's the bottom line. Now, I got to take a break here in a second. We'll take a look at filing 1099s against IRS agents. The tax protesters have some offensive actions, too, and they do some dirty tricks. And when you do that, that can get you put in prison. So hang on a second here, and let's take a little break, and we'll come right back and tell you a little bit more here about destroyed arguments. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the law hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the law hour, please go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. You know, when this federal income tax was launched back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy. It was the richest one-half of 1% of the population. And the top tax rate was only 7%. But today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the income tax have been more than fully realized. You know, by the end of Herbert Hoover's term in 1932, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. And by the time Franklin D. Roosevelt was done, the top rate was over 90%. Talk about a heavy progressive income tax. And then in addition, the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class. Now, the income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, including our English common law. And this income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. And that's why I contend that you at least owe it to yourself to ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? So for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it, would you? It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Tax and Status is a school that I teach. It's available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and then just send an email request for that free general law CD package. All right, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about destroyed arguments. Destroyed arguments, written by Larry B. Craft. It's on his website. I think you can probably find it. It's not here. At least I don't see it on his paperwork here, destroyed arguments. Let's see. Does he have... I don't see his website, and I don't see his email address here on the document itself. I imagine if you just looked up Beecraft, B-E-E-C-R-A-F-T, do a search, I think you'll find Larry Beecraft. Huntsville, Alabama. Pretty good old boy. And I think that if you get into trouble, you might need a lawyer someday. That's what he specializes in. He won't win every case every time, but he'll win a lot of cases. And you may have one of those kind of cases, but I would suggest, and I think Larry here would agree, that you can avoid more trouble than you can get out of, which is why he put this on his website. If you're involved in, or if you've been thinking about getting involved in some of these tax protest ideas, you know, like the money issue, or the IRS is a Delaware corporation, or the IMF argument, or non-resident aliens, or a codicil to a will, that's the first five. They've already been tested and found wanting. Let's try another one here. Filing 1099s against IRS agents. Now, that's a criminal activity. That's an aggressive action. And I had somebody do that to me one time. It wasn't, I don't think they're tax protesters per se, but I did a job for a guy one time and we had a little disagreement. And he filed a 1099 form, and he reported to the IRS that I had made $123,000, and he paid me that. Well, as soon as I got that, I went into the IRS, and I said, listen, look at this document here. This is a fraudulent document. It is true that I worked for this guy, but he didn't pay me $123,000. Here's what he did pay me. And it was under the filing minimum, and I didn't file a tax return. And what I want is for this guy to produce the checks or the contract. Well, the the taxing people took the documents and they went from there, and I never heard any more from them again. So evidently, I guess my story and my argument held water. Evidently, this guy didn't have any checks. Now, you see, if you write me a check for $10,000 every month, you know, $123,000 is $10,000 a month, isn't it? For 12 months is $120,000. Well, you'd have to be paying me $10,000 a month every month for 12 months. And I'd have to be cashing those checks, so there'd have to be an endorsement on the back of the checks, wouldn't there? So when you file a 1099 form and you name somebody and you say, I paid that guy $10,000 a month over these various months, the burden is going to shift to you. The minute that guy denies that and says, I didn't do that. They didn't pay me that. And I want you to bring the contract in. I want you to bring in these canceled checks. That's the evidence. See, when you're working at General Motors, you've got endorsements on the back of your check. That Mexican, you know, who's working under the table for $5 an hour, he doesn't have any evidence against him. You do. That's where these tax protesters are going to fall down on the job. I mean, if you're going to get involved in criminal activities, you know, your common sense ought to tell you, shouldn't you do something here to avoid detection? So I just went right into the IRS. You know, as soon as I got that, I said, well, you know, I'm going to be getting into trouble here. So I went in, and the tax people were pretty nice to me. They didn't get upset with me. I don't run away from government officials. I don't like to do business with government. That's why I don't have any income. I decided that income and income tax, second plank to the Communist Manifesto, probably wasn't in my best interest, so I just quit. So I make my living doing something else. But then this guy got into trouble himself, because then the taxing authorities called this guy and they said, well, now, why did you write this 1099 form? Well, I was just mad at Gordon, and I just wanted to get even with him, and I just did. Well, you know, that gets you into trouble. And you know, the courts have done some cases along that line. At one time, some asserted that when an agent of the federal government inflicted damage upon somebody, the proper response should be by filing a Form 1099 against the agent, because the agent was enriched by the damage so inflicted. Yeah, I'm not quite sure I understand the logic behind that. If the IRS agent did something to you and caused you a damage, let's see, what would they do to you? Well, let's suppose that they rejected your tax return and said you owe an extra $30,000. I guess by this line of reasoning, well, if they rejected my tax return and found that I owed another $30,000, I've been damaged that $30,000. It couldn't be that I made an error on my tax return and I owe another $30,000. It's that if you catch me, then you're causing me a $30,000 damage. So I'm going to fill out a 1099 form and name you for this $30,000, which in effect is saying that I paid you this $30,000. Does that sound bizarre? Sounds pretty bizarre to me. And it sounded pretty bizarre to the courts, too, because in United States versus Yagow, Yagow, 953 Fed 2nd, 423, and United States versus Kubal, 976 Fed 2nd, 529, and United States versus Dykstra, 991 Fed 2nd, 450, three cases there, they came to the same conclusion, and these three guys all went to jail, filling out 1099 forms, and sending that into the IRS, alleging that this person over here has been paid $30,000 or $50,000 or whatever the number is. That's a crime to do that. So if somebody works for you and you file a 1099, you want to make sure that you've got a canceled check there, that this guy that you paid him and then sent the 1099 into the government, and you follow the rules, you follow the law. That's what laws are for. It's there to follow the law. If you're a taxpayer, you ought to be paying the income tax. It's just that simple. And if you don't want to pay the income tax, then I guess the logical thing is to stop having income. That was my conclusion. It's worked for 21 years. I avoid income like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Well, if somebody comes along and says, hey, Gordon, let's go out and have a little fun down at Flo's Whorehouse. Let's go commit adultery. I try to stay away from that, and I tell them, no, I think I'll stay away from Flo's. And when they come to me and say, hey, let's go out and evade our taxes. Let's go out and have some income and let's not pay our taxes. I tell them, no, I don't want to do that either. So when somebody suggests to you that you break the law, you know, you need to say no. And if you're not sure, shouldn't you go look it up? Shouldn't you go talk to somebody, you know, an attorney, a CPA, or, you know, somebody out there, a doctor, you know, could probably tell you, you know, if somebody suggests you go down to Flo's Whorehouse, you know, go to your local doctor and say, well, what do you think I ought to do? And I think the doctor would probably tell you, you know, you'd be better off if you stayed out of there. But if you're going to go in there, why, maybe you better use a condom, or maybe you better practice safe sex or something. You know, if you're going to evade your taxes, shouldn't you do something to cover your tracks? And after all, that's what people are telling you when they tell you to practice safe sex. They're saying, well, go out and break the law, but do something to cover your tracks so that you don't get caught. If you're going to go to Flo's Whorehouse, use a condom so that you don't get AIDS, herpes, or VD. If you're going to practice sodomy, at least use a condom so that you don't get AIDS. That's what they're telling you. When you're going to break the law, do something to hide it. Just, you know, common sense to tell you that. Of course, today we have essentially the same thing in the format of filing common law liens. That's another little twist on tax protest. More than enough people have gone to jail with this kind of lunacy. And recently, Roger Elvick, who went to jail for doing this, has again incorporated into his redemption process this same scheme. A little later on, we'll talk about the straw man and redemption and UCC. It's a tax protest scheme is what it boils down to in the final analysis. And that's the latest rage. That's what's going around the country right now. People come in here and they'll tell me about how they got a straw man. And I've had people try to explain that to me, and I don't think they can explain it to me, and I can't understand it. I had a great big thick binder here one time a lady sent me. It must have had 500 pages in it. And my conclusion was that it was probably insane. I couldn't understand it. Maybe it's because I'm not very smart. But I notice now that this UCC redemption program is being litigated in the courts. So far, every case that I've heard of is lost. And there are people out there that that promote this. A guy named Roger Elvick is one of them. Erwin Schiff is the second. And they all have some little twist, some little different program here that they'll come up with, and then they sell these packets and sell these concepts and ideas to people like you and me. It's up to you and I guess, to see through that and avoid it. The government doesn't stop them. There was an outfit called the Pilot Connection, and they were out selling a tax scheme. And I had a student in here one time. He was down in Mississippi, and he listened. He went to a public meeting, and he listened to it, and he bought into the program. At that same meeting, there were undercover tax agents there, and the tax agents took the license numbers down of the people that attended the meeting, and then they audited all those people over a period of years. And they prosecuted and convicted a lot of those people that had responded to that ad, but they never prosecuted the Pilot Connection, not in Mississippi. I thought that was the equivalent of entrapment. You know, if in our state here, every once in a while on the 6 o'clock news, they'll say, well, there's this scam going on here in Springfield, and they're selling siding over here and not delivering the goods, and the Attorney General has closed them down, or there's this telephone bank. I mean, they warn you about things like that. You'd think that the government would warn you about Erwin Schiff and warn you about the Pilot Connection, wouldn't you? That the government would warn you about this codicil to a will and these tax protest schemes, but they don't. You see, the government sits back, and they let the tax protest schemers steal from you first of all, by giving you bad information, and then the government comes in after you stop paying your taxes, and then they prosecute you for the tax evasion, and they get you coming and going. The tax protesters get you coming, and the IRS and the state tax commission get you when you're going. You know, those tax protesters are like pilot fish in a shark's mouth. It's a symbiotic relationship between pilot fish and sharks. And there's a symbiotic relationship between tax protesters and the government taxing agencies. That's why I say it's time to help take a bite out of crime. The government is criminal, and the tax protesters are criminal. You got two criminal elements over here preying upon ignorant people because they listen to a sales pitch and this sounds logical, and so they buy it. That's what happens to people when a sighting salesman comes by. You know, it sounds like it's a pretty good deal, and I'd like to buy this good deal. They give them their money, and they split town, and they steal from you. Tax protesters do the same thing. They're just stealing from you, like pilot fish working in a shark's mouth. Then there's a thing here called land patents. Back in 1983 and 84, Carol Landy popularized an argument that the land patent was the highest and best form of title, and that by updating the patent in your own name, you could defeat any mortgages. This contention violated many principles of real property law. And when Carol started trying to get patents for most of the land in California brought up into her own name, she went to jail. Others who have raised this crazy argument have lost that issue also. That's where I met Larry Beecraft, was over this land foreclosure thing. We were called, at least I don't know about him, I never did ask him about that, but guy called me over to Colorado. I was running a company called Barristers Inn at the time, law school. And what they were doing over there was trying to help farmers save their property. And one of the techniques that they were using, or that I'd first come into contact with, was this thing called the land patent. And Chuck Walters was promoting that at the time, back in the early 80s, you know, this thing of the land patent. And land patents have a legitimate legal basis in land law. There's a real thing out here called a land patent. They've been around since about 1820. And I've got a land patent on my farm here. It was signed by Woodrow Wilson in 1914. But I'm not using it to evade or avoid income tax. It doesn't have anything to do with the income tax, and it doesn't do anything for me with my property tax here either. It just doesn't attach to that. That's not the purpose of it. And law has reason, logic, and common sense attached to it. And that's what you need to keep in mind, that the law is based upon reason, logic, and common sense. You may not like the law. Maybe you don't like the seatbelt law, or you don't like the speed law, or you don't like, you know, the income tax law. But all of those laws are very reasonable, very logical, and they make sense. You see, Americans want all these government benefits. Our founding fathers gave us a limited government, a republican form of government, very limited in scope. The federal government didn't give out food stamps. They weren't involved in public schools. We didn't have a Department of Education, you know, back in 1830. We didn't have free education for all children in public school. The federal government wasn't involved in education. They weren't involved in welfare. They weren't involved in workplace safety. And for some reason, Americans bought into the program that the government should be more inclusive, that the government should regulate the workplace. And so we got OSHA, and that the government should be more concerned about environmental pollution. So we got the EPA, and that the government should be more concerned about public schools and get involved in things like that. Well, all those things cost money. And the federal government has employed about 3 million people. And those people have to be paid every Friday. And you know, somebody came up with a neat idea. I think it was Franklin Roosevelt in the New Deal. And they said, well, we got to have retirement for people. We got to have Social Security. Well, look, boys and girls, let's be intelligent. If you have a government that's limited, then you don't need very much tax to pay limited government. But if you're going to have an all-pervasive government that can provide you retirement benefits when you retire, don't you have to have some way to pay for that? So that's why we have a Social Security tax. And if you're going to have government agents out here protecting you in the workplace, doesn't somebody have to pay those guys? So, if you're going to have OSHA, then you got to have income tax or some kind of tax somewhere along the line to pay for that, don't you? Now somebody says, well, I don't want that. Well, then stop participating in it. That judge asked me that one time, you know. He said, well, if you're opposed to all of this, why do you take the benefits? See, at the time, I had a Social Security number. And he asked me that. He says, do you have a Social Security number? I said, well, of course. He says, well, if you're opposed to all of these government benefits, why are you a participant in it? I thought that was a pretty logical question. The judge knew and understood that Social Security is what ties you to this income tax, ties you to these government benefits. Get rid of your Social Security number and you can get rid of about 90% of your problem. It's kind of like doing business with the mafia. If you're going to do business with the mafia, that's a dangerous organization. You know, those people play hardball. They kill people. My brother was a drug dealer, and he told me that there's real honor among thieves. He said, you know, when you hear somebody being shot and killed, you know, over a drug deal, it's because he didn't pay. And when somebody doesn't pay over a drug deal, you can't sue them in small claims court. Judge Wapner won't give you a decision, you know, over a bad drug deal. So somebody has to enforce thou shalt not steal in the drug world, and so they do it by killing them. But you know, if you don't deal in drugs, you won't have that problem. Now, I've never dealt in drugs. My brother told me, he said, it's a pretty rough and tumble world out there. And he said, you got to make sure that you pay your supplier, because if you don't, you'll end up dead. Now, I got that from a drug dealer. If you don't pay your supplier, you'll end up dead. But there's honor among thieves. You see, drug dealers do drug deals and do business all the time. Until, you know, somebody gets greedy and they go out and they rip off their supplier. And then the supplier says, well, I can't go to Judge Wapner and file a civil action in court, so I'll have to take care of this myself. And they do. So you want to tuck that away in your heart. Well, the government is the same way. The government's just like the mafia. It's a criminal enterprise. It's a criminal activity. It violates the First Commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. That's number one. They break a lot of other laws, too. They encourage you to pay the income tax, and they tell you, don't tithe, pay the income tax. They tell you, hey, don't practice strict liability, practice Social Security. And, you know, we buy into that program. Well, when you buy into that program, there's penalties that have to be paid. And when you don't pay your taxes, you know, the government comes along and says, well, we got to enforce the law. We got to enforce our program. And so they lock you up in jail. But it's because you're doing business with them. If you never do business with a drug dealer, you'll never have problems with the drug dealers. If you never do business with the government, you'll never have problems with the government. And that's been my experience. I don't do business with drug dealers. I don't have any problems with drug dealers. I don't do business with the government, and I don't have any problems with the government. I used to do business with the government. My God, I had nothing but problems. I had OSHA inspectors coming into my factory. I had EPA agents all over me. I had the tax people hounding me and auditing me all the time. As soon as I terminated my contracts with the government and got out of it, stopped doing business with criminals, they stopped doing business with me. I haven't had a problem since. So I opened a law school and I said, well, gee, let me share this with other people. That's why I told you. I said, I think you can avoid more problems than you can get out of. Well, these land patents, there's seven cases that Larry cites here. Landry versus Phelps, 740, Fed Second, 710. And then Hilgeford, H-I-L-G-E-F-O-R-D versus People's Bank, cited at 607 Federal Supplement, 536. And then Nixon versus individual head of St. Joseph's Mortgage Company, cited at 612 Fed Supplement 253. Now, there's three cases out of the seven where people have gone in with a land patent and said, well, I got a mortgage here. This Ronnie Nixon, I think it's probably Ronnie L. Nixon, I cite in my tax school, and the Circuit Court of Appeals had a pretty good reply to him. He said, I don't owe this mortgage because the bank didn't lend me gold. It was a takeoff on the Article 1, Section 10 gold and silver issue, and so Ronnie Nixon said, I'm not going to pay my mortgage, and they can't take my house away from me because they didn't loan me gold. And so the court said, well, what did they loan you? Well, they lent me credit. Well, good, pay credit back. That's what Federal Reserve notes are, they're credit. It's what checks are, credit. It's called a discharge in equity. That's why God told you, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. He said, use just weights and balances. It was God that gave us gold and silver coin. It was our founding fathers that followed Leviticus 19:35 and 36 and Exodus 20, verse 15, that says, thou shalt not steal. They followed that law. They codified it into our Constitution. And they gave us just weights and balances, hard money, that's called. They had experienced soft money and paper money from 1692 to 1792. And they lost their shirts, and they said, well, this paper money, these unjust weights and balances don't work very well. So let's change that, and let's go back and obey God and keep His commandments, and they did. And from 1792 to about 1932, we Americans prospered. We became the wealthiest and most powerful nation in the world. Our economy was the envy of the world. Today we're the world's number one debtor nation. We used to be the world's number one creditor nation when we used gold and silver, just weights and balances. When we made the change, well, okay, we got a penalty. We Americans collectively now owe $149 trillion. That's more than everything in America is worth, including all the land and all the fixtures that are attached to it and all the raw materials and natural resources. They're not worth $149 trillion, and that's what we owe. And we have to pay interest on the debt. We don't have enough money to pay it. Our founding fathers knew that, and they codified Article 1, Section 10 for that reason. And they never gave us an income tax. They gave us a limited government. The government of God was a limited government. The people said, we don't want a limited government. We want a king like all the nations around us that can give us Social Security and workplace protection, OSHA, the EPA. And to pay for that, you got to have taxes. I mean, it's just common sense. So I don't take any government benefits, and I don't pay very many government taxes. Now, anytime you take a benefit, you go down here and buy gasoline, you're taking a benefit, and you got to pay the tax. So the 40-cent tax that you're paying for that gas is so we can build a road for you to drive your car on. Hire a highway patrolman to go out there and give you a ticket when you drive too fast. I mean, that's just where reality's at, boys and girls. Hey, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll be back with more on Destroyed Arguments next time. That'll be tomorrow night, same time, same station. So be sure that we have an appointment, 8 o'clock every night, right here. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to the website georgegordon.org. GeorgeGordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. All right, there's a signal that says my time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends. Mm-hmm.